Coming up, Bob Faugh reports on the number one human rights issue in the world, according to former President Jimmy Carter.
The worst human rights abuse on earth right now is by far the abuse of women and girls.
And legal affairs correspondent Tim O'Brien on what's next for the death penalty and legislative prayer. Plus, Kim Lawton profiles one of the places Pope Francis will be visiting later this month, the Jordan River Baptism Site, where many believe Jesus was baptized.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. International support continues to grow for nearly 300 schoolgirls kidnapped by Islamist militants in Nigeria. Here in the U.S., the Bring Back Our Girls campaign gained momentum. Activists held several protests, including one at the Nigerian embassy in Washington. They called on the Nigerian government to do more to rescue the girls, and they urged more U.S. help. American Muslim groups called for the girls' immediate release, saying the kidnappers had violated core Islamic teachings. In Sudan's Nuba Mountains, the Catholic Mother of Mercy Hospital was bombed by the Sudanese Air Force. The attack was caught on video by Nuba Reports, a local network of journalists. The bombing also disrupted a worship service. There were injuries, but no reported deaths. Mother of Mercy is the only working hospital in the region. Prominent retired Catholic Bishop Max Gassis called the attack a crime against humanity. Sudan's Islamist government has been fighting rebels in the predominantly Christian and animist area. Here at home, a new government report, the National Climate Assessment, prepared by a large cross-section of scientists, says, quote, climate change, once considered an issue for a distant future, has moved firmly into the present and is being felt in every region of the country. President Obama is expected to propose next month major new limits on power plant emissions. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled this week that local governments can begin their meetings with prayer, even if they explicitly favor one religion. In the 5-4 decision, the court said such prayers do not violate the Constitution as long as they don't proselytize or demean other faiths. The case involved the New York town of Greece, where council meetings routinely opened with Christian prayers. Conservative Christian groups said the ruling was a victory for religious freedom, but religious minorities and secular advocates said it amounted to religious favoritism. This week, a bipartisan group of criminal justice experts called for sweeping reforms in the way the death penalty is carried out across the country. The report made 39 recommendations, including reducing the number of drugs used in lethal injections. This came 2 weeks after the botched execution in Oklahoma of a convicted murderer. Panel member and former Virginia Attorney General Mark Early, a Republican, said unless changes are made, quote, the administration of capital punishment is unjust, disproportionate, and very likely unconstitutional. Now, more about the increasingly controversial death penalty and about the limits of religious freedom with longtime legal affairs correspondent Tim O'Brien. Tim, welcome. Let's start with the Supreme Court's decision this week. Can you summarize it?
Well, the court noted we have a long history of beginning legislative sessions with some prayer, but this case was different. The prayer was almost uniformly Christian, given by a Christian, usually a priest. And the Supreme Court said that still is okay. It doesn't violate the First Amendment ban on establishing religion, so long as the prayer is not demeaning one faith over another or proselytizing.
But a lot of people in other religious traditions and seculars are very worried about that decision.
That is understandable. This invocation had all the trappings of a Catholic Mass, although it was only a few minutes long. There doesn't seem to be any limiting factor other than the ones we mentioned. Proselytizing, you can't have that, and you can't demean another faith. So we don't know where the end is, but the message is a green light to city councils and town boards and state legislatures that if you want to do this, you can.
Okay, and the death penalty. That botched execution in Oklahoma revived all of the old arguments about the death penalty, for it, against it.
Right.
Where are we now in that?
Well, the country's long been divided over whether to have it and has decided that we will have it in 33 states. But that only led to even more difficult questions. How do you do it? How do you implement it? And can you do it fairly and rationally?
And you and your colleague studied this in your book, Murder at the Supreme Court. What did you find?
Well, we chronicled the major death penalty cases to reach the Supreme Court. We found a uniformity there, too, that all the crimes and the criminals were truly horrendous, and they cried out for very severe punishment. And it helped us better understand why people feel so strongly in favor of capital punishment.
And the argument for getting rid of it?
Well, we also discovered that, too, the difficulties. It's very, very challenging. I mean, one, we're always concerned about executing someone who didn't commit the crime. The evolution of DNA now shows that concern is even greater. That risk is greater than we thought it was. Race figures into it. If the victim is white, the defendant is much more likely to get a death sentence than if the victim is of a minority. It's very difficult to provide adequate legal counsel. And there's no way of predicting who is going to get a death sentence and who won't. I mean, there are roughly 15,000 murders in the United States every year and only about 80 death sentences. It seems to be irrational.
And what's your sense of the way the tide is running on that?
Well, one by one, states are abandoning it. No state is adopting it. But the real significant change is that those states that have the death penalty are not implementing it. So it's becoming less and less common. Last year, only 39 death sentences, with 3,000 people on death row. We appear to be approaching the point where the Supreme Court could say it is so unusual and so cruel as to violate the Eighth Amendment. It's not going to happen tomorrow. It might not be in our lifetime, but it seems to be the direction that we're moving.
Tim O'Brien, many thanks.
Thank you.
In Geneva this week, a UN panel sharply criticized Vatican officials over the church's handling of clergy sex abuse cases. Church officials defended their record, saying they had dismissed more than 800 priests for sex abuse over the past decade. The panel was convened to review the Vatican's compliance with a treaty against torture, which the UN committee defines to include child abuse. Meanwhile, the Vatican's chief of doctrine accused the largest umbrella group of U.S. nuns of not cooperating with disciplinary measures imposed in 2012. In unusually blunt language, the official specifically criticized the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, or LCWR, for selecting conference speakers and honoring a feminist theologian who the Vatican believes advanced grave doctrinal errors. The LCWR said it is committed to dialogue, but that the nuns, quote, do not recognize ourselves in the doctrinal assessment. U.S. Hispanics are leaving the Catholic Church in large numbers, according to a Pew Research Center study released this week. 55% of U.S. Hispanics identify as Catholic today, down 12% from 2010. The report also suggests that more Hispanics are becoming evangelical Protestants or leaving religion altogether. We have a special report today on what former President Jimmy Carter and others call the world's number one human rights issue, the abuse of women and girls, in many ways, abroad and here at home. Bob Fall reports.
The abuse of women is a worldwide epidemic. Every year, according to the United Nations, nearly 700,000 women and girls are traded across international borders and sold into sexual slavery. Tens of thousands more are beaten, raped, and murdered. One quarter of all American women, by some estimates, will be victims of domestic abuse in their lifetime. Milan Verveer, the first United States ambassador at large for global women's issues, is now with the Institute for Women, Peace, and Security at Georgetown University.
It is a global scourge. It incurs a great set of limitations on individuals, much of half the population of the world. Women have enormous agency that is being kept back, and so they are not only being shortchanged, but our world is being shortchanged.
Full-time female workers earn, on average, 23% less than men. While women perform 66% of the world's work, says the United Nations, women make up the largest block of the world's poor. Jawat Ali of Pakistan.
Of course they are working, but they do not have recognition as a separate entity. No woman's name is ever recorded in the registers. Whatever work she does is noted down with her man.
Hi, everyone.
Former President Jimmy Carter and his wife Rosalynn have traveled the world championing human rights and charitable causes. And from what Carter has seen and studied, he says the abuse and exploitation of women is the world's gravest issue. He recently wrote a book about it.
The worst human rights abuse on earth right now is by far the abuse of women and girls. And this takes place not only in every foreign country, but also in the United States quite severely.
In much of the developing world, boys are prized so much more than girls that newborn females are killed and female fetuses are destroyed.
You abort a female fetus because you have this great desire that somehow she is not of the same level, the same worth, as the son is.
Some policies like one child per family and extreme poverty, President Carter says, cause parents to choose boys over girls because boys are more able to support the family.
We believe about 40 million people were killed in the Second World War. Four times as many little baby girls have been killed in this generation by their own parents, who strangled the little girls at birth. Sonograms have become available to remote villages, and now they can detect the sex of a developing fetus. And after about 12 weeks or so, if they discern that it's going to be a girl baby, they abort the fetus.
In some countries like India and China, with so many females aborted, there are not enough women available to marry. So girls are stolen from their parents and shipped off to be child brides.
I prayed for my daughter in the mosque, and I gave sacrificial offerings, and I keep praying so I can find her.
Carter says the World Health Organization estimates that 122 million women and girls have been subjected to female genital mutilation.
What could I do as a child? The adults make the decision for me. It was not your choice.
There are about 25 countries in Africa, almost half the females have their genitals mutilated. It's a custom that's perpetuated by women only. Husbands don't insist on it. Mullahs don't insist on it. The government doesn't insist on it. In fact, there's a law against it. But women were circumcised when they were children, and they feel it is proper for them to circumcise their little baby daughter.
Carter and others say one root cause of the abuse of women is the misreading of scripture or sacred text, legitimizing male dominance over females.
The great religions misinterpret their scriptures. The men leaders of their great religions select verses from the Holy Bible or from the Quran to show that women should be given relegated to a secondary position in the eyes of God. And this gives a potential abusive husband or an employer who wants to pay less to women employees than men an excuse: if women are not equal in the eyes of God, why should I treat her equal in my business or in my home?
While Carter says he has great respect for many denominations, he is uncomfortable that Catholic women cannot be priests and deacons. That kind of restriction hit a personal note for Carter and his wife in the year 2000, when a conservative group took over the Southern Baptist Convention of which the Carters were members.
They mandated that women could no longer be pastors or deacons or chaplains. Those kind of things disturbed me, and so we now belong to a Baptist church in Plains, Georgia, and we've had female pastors and men pastors.
The term gendercide, or missing millions, refers to females eliminated by abortion, neglect, and murder. And Ambassador Verveer says if the culture which permits those practices does not change, neither will the abuses.
Women who birth daughters are being made to feel in many places that somehow they have failed. They have failed miserably. And often those girls are the last fed, if they're fed at all, and they are denied any prospect of the kind of life that they deserve.
Both Verveer and Carter feel that too many religious leaders have remained silent about these issues, and that until that changes, progress will be slow.
There needs to be a stronger collective, a voice that says, enough already. We should not be treating half of our world's population in the way they are being treated. And yet there isn't that kind of reaction that says there is no place in our faith communities for any of this. And it's not just religious leaders. We need political leaders across the board to be recognizing these issues for the serious issues that they are.
The problems are systemic, but progress is being made. In Senegal, for example, one individual, Molly Melchin, has rallied villagers and stemmed the practice of female genital mutilation. President Carter's book proposes 23 other remedies, like prosecuting not just prostitutes, but also their male customers. And on university campuses, where almost one in four women say they have been raped, withholding federal funds if universities don't vigorously prosecute the campus rapists.
College presidents and deans don't want it to be known that rape takes place on college campuses. So they discourage the girls from reporting the rapes. And we have the same problem within the military.
Carter and others agree very little progress or change is likely without a change of mindset.
I do think it requires just a real commitment and understanding, particularly on the part of people in power, wherever that power is. We know that women who have incomes spend those incomes in ways that have a multiplier effect. They invest in their families, they invest in education and health care, they raise the standard of living in every place in which they make these investments. That multiplier effect is extremely important to our economies.
Because women are much more inclined to want to do something about their poor and starving people, the ones who are greatly in need. And women are more champions of peace, I would say, on the average, than of men. So in every way, women need to be extolled, and they'll make our society better.
To remove that global scourge, it will take a whole village and then some. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Bob Fall in Atlanta.
In other news, Jordan has opened a sprawling new refugee camp for tens of thousands of Syrians who keep pouring into the country. The Azraq camp will be able to hold up to 130,000 people. Many faith-based groups are already working there. The new facility was needed because the Zatri camp, which opened in 2012, has vastly exceeded its capacity. Officials estimate that more than 1 million Syrians have sought refuge in Jordan. Jordan is one of the scheduled stops on Pope Francis's trip to the Holy Land later this month. He's invited several Syrian refugees and disabled people to join him at the Jordan River baptism site while he's there on May 24th. The site is revered by many as the place where Jesus was baptized. Although there are other supposed baptism sites, recently discovered archaeological ruins are giving this spot new prominence. Kim Lawton visited there earlier this year.
These days, the Jordan River is smaller and muddier than first-time visitors are often expecting. But for many Christians, Jews, and Muslims, it's one of the most sacred places on earth. According to the Bible, Joshua crossed the Jordan River when he led the Israelites into the Promised Land. The Jordan River was where the prophet Elijah was taken into heaven, and his successor, Elisha, took up his mantle. It's where John the Baptist lived and preached, and Jesus was baptized and began his public ministry.
Our Bible teaches that Christianity was born here.
Scholars and archaeologists have long debated exactly where at the river the events took place, and there are rival theories. But recent discoveries have focused attention on this place, Wadi el-Qarar, in the country of Jordan, near the Dead Sea, just over the border from Israel. Rustam Mikjian is assistant director of the site. He looks to the Bible for confirmation.
2 Kings chapter 2, around 800 years before Christ, it's very clear that Elijah comes with Elisha, his disciple, from Jericho, that's right opposite, cross the river Jordan.
According to the Gospels, John the Baptist came in the spirit and strength of Elijah. He lived and worked in a place called Bethany beyond the Jordan.
The place where the prophets crossed is the place where John baptized, opposite Jericho. So everything matches 100%.
Accounts from Christians as far back as the 5th century describe a major pilgrimage site along the Jordan River associated with Elijah, John the Baptist, and Jesus. But with the Crusades and the rise of the Ottoman Empire, the pilgrimages gradually stopped, and the site was eventually buried by layers of history. Then in 1897, a mosaic map from the 6th century was discovered in the floor of a Jordanian church. It gave archaeologists new clues about where the ancient pilgrimage site may have been. But World Wars I and II, and then the Arab-Israeli Wars, made the area inaccessible. For decades, it was a militarized zone full of landmines. After the 1994 peace treaty between Jordan and Israel, the mines were cleared, and archaeologists could finally begin searching. The discoveries were stunning. In the barren wilderness, there were the ruins of a large monastery complex built in the 5th century, which matched early pilgrim descriptions of a church built on the place where they believed Elijah was taken into heaven. The complex was built over an ancient cave where pilgrims said John the Baptist had lived.
From Elijah's Hill, where we discovered the monastery, down to the River Jordan, 3 kilometers to the west, it's a huge open monastery because we have hundreds of caves scattered around this holy valley, and monks and hermits stayed here.
A small distance away, where the river once flowed, ruins were discovered of baptism pools and of 5 different churches, all built over successive periods of time. And there were the remains of marble steps, which would have led down to the water. All of this, too, matched 6th, 7th, and 8th century pilgrim descriptions of churches built to revere the place where John baptized Jesus.
Why did they insist to build their churches here? Depending on the Bible, depending on the pilgrims' accounts and the archaeological discoveries, we know this is the spot where Jesus baptized and Christianity started.
Many churches hold special services here to commemorate the baptism of Jesus, which Christians consider a key event in the gospel stories. Since the baptism launched Jesus' earthly ministry, many here consider it the starting point of the Christian faith.
And once Jesus comes out of the water, the Holy Spirit descends and the voice of the Lord says, "He is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased."
The proclamation of the one God and the Holy Trinity, that is Christianity.
The Jordanian royal family opened the site in 2011 for tourism and pilgrimages, but they want to keep the archaeological area as natural as possible. Plots of land surrounding the area have been given to several Christian denominations, which have begun building churches, guest houses, and other facilities. Local Christians say this site, more than 350 meters below sea level, is a place of profound spirituality.
This is the lowest point on earth, closest to heaven. So Christianity spreads from the lowest point on earth, all over the world. And maybe this is a lesson. I take it as a lesson for us. Where is Jesus born? In a cave. Where did Christianity start? Lowest point on earth.
As Jordanians, we carry this legacy with great pride and faith, and we want all the people to come here and see.
I'm Kim Lawton at the Jordan River.
Finally, on our calendar this week, Buddhists celebrate Buddha Day when they mark the birth, spiritual awakening, and death of the historical Buddha. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. And visit our website where there's always much more and where you can also listen to or watch each of our programs. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, a music video from the Muslim Public Affairs Council with Muslims dancing to artist Pharrell Williams' iconic song, Happy. MPAC says it wanted to showcase the diversity of its community.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.